Every festive we wake up with the damn sparrows. But Nzala, no, she's up at 1 p.m. Kari, ooh, unuga, kamnandi. And we're like, but where you been though? Here opening pots like you cooked.
A combination meal, inspired by seven colors, is something for everyone. Nando's, fire it up.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Oh shit, I just killed that song. Oi, 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 that wasn't good. What an awful move, what an amateurish thing to do. I'm always making mistakes. Alright, so let's get into it. It's just after 7 o'clock. You know, we only play songs anyway on this show because we want to create a break between the podcasts. So it's not like it matters. All right, Mubs has got some news. Let's see what's happening in the world. Go ahead, Mubs.
Well, SARS have said that there is a decline in personal income tax contributions.
Oh, you don't say. Really? Is it because the government that SARS worked for ruined the economy? Could it be because people are sick and tired of handing over their hard-earned cash so that the government can waste that money and corrupt activities will divert that money into the pockets of people who least deserve it?
Well, the speculation, Gareth, is that a lot of it is attributed to consumer reluctance and also a slip in tax compliance. The revenue service says that tax revenue collection has almost doubled in the last decade. However, when it comes to personal income tax, which is the largest contributor to revenue, mm-hmm. they have witnessed a drop. It's a drop.
Oh, yeah, there okay. we go. Sorry, I was just confused.
I wish I heard myself when I spoke. It is a slowdown from the previous growth levels. In the past, it used to grow by over 12%, which they say speaks directly to the moderation of bonuses that were paid out in the financial sector. And they say it also speaks to the reluctance of companies to hire. And then there's also the issue of a lot of managers having lost their jobs. So that's according to SARS.
There's also lazy. Like, doing tax is a mission. And it's a mission and it sucks. And like, if you're busy and you've got important stuff that actually brings you a tangible benefit in your life to get through, then I'm always late with my tax return and it's nothing personal. I just hate doing it and it always ends up being the stressful mission. So maybe people are busy and have got life to live.
You know, also, if you consider 34% of the total tax taken in by government, 34% of it is personal income tax. So this is people's take-home money. This is what they get to take home after all the deductions and all the rest of it. This is their money, and government then take a piece of that pie, and it's anywhere between 20 and 45%. It's even 46%.
Yeah.
Anyway, 34% of the total income to the fiscus is from personal income tax. And do you know how many people in this country pay personal income tax?
Not a lot.
Maybe 12, maybe 15%. That was the last time I checked. Wow. I think it's probably even less now. Now, I don't know how that's sustainable. I don't know how that works. I mean, why should, call it 15%, why should 15% of the population be responsible for making sure that that much of the money is brought in? It doesn't seem equitable. You know, we're talking about fairness in the world. We're talking about, well, you know, it's got to be fair to poor people, it's got to be fair to rich people, it's got to be fair to everybody. Everybody's going to have a fair shot at the world.
I don't mind a little bit of light socialism. I know you probably don't agree, Gareth, but like, I don't mind if...
There's no such thing as light socialism.
No, there is. There's degrees of socialism. And I don't mind a little bit where, like, fundamental, if you live in a country where there's opportunities afforded to you by the infrastructure in the state that you wouldn't have had in another country, and you maybe got quality education for free for your kids and decent medical.
There's no such thing as free. Nothing's free.
Yes, but I mean, the point is, I wouldn't mind if my tax went to things where I could tangibly see people who have way lower level of privileges and way lower opportunities to private schools and private hospitals and stuff. I see their lives getting better. Like, actually, cool, yeah, man, that's rad. I've been paying tax and they're building cool schools and all of that cool stuff. And then I would be a bit more inclined to be like, yeah, this isn't just bullshit. And you talked about the variation between the percentage of tax paid. I went into a much higher tax bracket doing a certain job a year and a half ago. I was earning more money than what I was used to, and I didn't do an actual sum, but the amount that my salary went up and the amount of more money that I got out because I went into a higher tax bracket was like really notable. It was like, yeah, let's say you were earning 1,000 rand and now you're earning 1,800 rand, mm-hmm. and you're taking home an extra 300 rand. That was a terrible analogy, but the point was, you have to earn a lot more money to keep ahead of tax.
Oh yeah, and as you say, you get nothing for it. And I don't expect tax to work just for me. I expect tax to work for the country. And at this point, the government have shown themselves wholly incapable of making tax work for the country. They are not capable of distributing this money to the useful and purposeful and meaningful tasks that are assigned to them.
That's the stuff I'm talking about.
We don't see hospitals being improved, schools being built. We don't see opportunities afforded to people who want to employ themselves or to do things and get jobs and be productive citizens. All we see is that the elite are skimming off the top and taking as much as they can out of the fiscus. That's all we see. So why would you want to pay tax? Why would you want to be a good tax law-abiding citizen?
I've got a theory, though, that, like, and I'd actually like to get your take on this, Gareth. The total, like, crumbling and shitness of the education system in South Africa, it's either just negligence, ineptitude, lack of qualification, and just a symptom of a government that can't get anything right, or it's a deliberate strategy to deliberately dismantle that system. Because if you have an educated generation, especially one who don't remember apartheid, and you teach them like how things are supposed to work and how systems are meant to work and how democracy is supposed to work and tax is supposed to work and all of that, they're going to be like, hang on a second, things are pretty poked. I'm going to vote for someone else. But if they don't know any of that, and they just know that the soccer team we support is the ANC, they'll go vote.
But that's assuming that people live their lives to vote. We've got a much bigger problem in this country.
People have bigger priorities. People are trying to survive every day. People wake up, and the thoughts occupying their mind is, how am I going to put food on the table today? The ANC is not the number one thought that they wake up to when you're trying to survive.
That's a really good point.
And remember, more than half the people in this country don't even vote. Jeez. And a lot of those people are uneducated, and they're just despairing. They just don't have anyone that they can rely on. They don't bother to go and vote because they just, it's not a priority to them, as Mabali says. They don't care. They're not interested in politics. So if that were true, and it's a bit of a conspiracy theory in some respects, because it sounds like the sort of thing that would be cooked up by a government. If a government were able to cook up anything, and this government can't even cook up a miso soup.
They've cooked up Jacob Zuma into power for 12 years despite total bullshit.
Jacob Zuma, let's give him some credit. He's done a lot of that.
He can cook some shit up. He's like the Colonel Sanders of South African politics.
But here's the deal. If the education system is poor, everybody loses. Government lose, the ordinary citizens lose, the smart people lose, the people who are not connected to any kind of network lose, impoverished rural communities get more and more impoverished. I mean, education is so important. If you don't have a way of understanding the world around you, if you don't have access to information, if you don't have someone to teach you how to add, how to read, how to write, these are things that are so basic and so massively important that you will never be able to put food on the table if you don't have them.
Yeah.
Education is the key.
I've always believed that, and I'd never claim to be a political expert, but I've always said, like, the simple way, when things are complicated and convoluted and structures and systems are all interwoven and it seems overwhelming and you don't know where to start pulling on the strings, and they just, you know, like cables behind your TV set, they just get more tangled the more you pull on them. Just pump every cent, every available cent, and a few that you've got to siphon from somewhere else, just get all the money and put it into schools. And just bang that for 10, 15 years.
But then those schools have to be run properly.
Sure.
We can't have SAD too, because they go on strike all the time and don't care about the students.
Yes,
we've got to have a Minister of Education who actually doesn't care about just outcomes-based education, but a general knowledge of how the world works and some logic and some soft skills and all of that. Listen, it's a complicated
thing. All of that good stuff.
I wouldn't want it. That's why I don't run for government. That's why I'm not a politician. I'm not interested in solving the world's problems. But these guys say they do want to solve the world's problems. They say they want to help people. That's why they want to stand for office. Now, I think, to go back to taxation is theft. You're stealing from people who've worked hard for that money. You didn't work hard for it as government. You don't get to take half people's money. It's theft. And there's no such thing as socialism light. I agree with Ben. That's a whole discussion for another day. What else is there, Mubs?
It really is problematic, because when you said that the majority of people don't vote, it really is problematic that the decision that gets taken of who is going to be in charge of the running of the country is determined by a minority group.
They say about
It is hugely problematic.
I say about 40% of people who vote, and of that, the only about 12.5 million people voted ANC in the last election. So that means, and I'm not talking about the provincial one, I'm talking about the national election. So 12.5 million people, they say, get to decide for the rest of us. We're a population of 55 million people.
Yeah, wow.
Just think about that.
Yeah, no.
So is democracy even a real thing?
Oh.
Do elections work? And how do we then empower these people to take half our money? How does that work?
But how do you stop them? How do you go, okay, I want to form a human chain. You know when you block the freeway with a human chain? I want to form a human chain that blocks the money pipe that comes out of ordinary people into the government.
Good, we've done it with e-tolls.
Or just don't pay.
You just don't pay. You stop paying them. You stop giving them your money.
Everybody has to do it at once. The people who don't.
It's on very rare occasions that people in this country find a common ground where they can come together and agree on doing something together at the same time, all of us.
I think maybe stop paying money might be something people can get by.
Hey, here start a hashtag.
Here are the actual...
stop paying money.
Stop paying the money. In the 2015-2016 financial year, out of a total of 33 million eligible taxpayers, around 10%, or 3.3 million people, paid 93% of the total income tax collected in that period. Of them, 1.1 million, or 3.7% of all income taxpayers, paid just under 70% of all the income tax collected in that period. That means that South African income tax receipts are highly reliant on a relatively small number of high income taxpayers. If those people stop paying, the government collapses.
Not the worst thing I've heard in the world, the government collapses.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, if you got to keep half your money and you got to trade that money and spend it and, you know, do things with
Jewel it. Time.
Whatever. You're putting it back into the economy. It's bound to help. The fact that it now goes into this dark economy of hidden corrupt activities and practices.
Like Gringotts.
Exactly.
It goes down forever and there's all sorts of shit down there. No one understands.
Now, the fact that it goes there means that we're all losing. Anyway, let's move on. We can't keep talking about tax all morning.
Okay. So yesterday I noticed that Oscar Pistorius was trending, and that's because he got into a fight.
They
are far more important news. Like the fact that South African leaders from the Muslim, Jewish, and Christian faith all got together yesterday.
Allah Akbar, death to America.
They have expressed their solidarity, Gareth, in condemnation of President Donald Trump's and what they call his shameful decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. World continues to be upset with
religious leaders who created this shitstorm in Jerusalem in the first place are now they're all condemning Trump like he's the one who started all of these religions who are fighting over a little piece of ground. Beautiful job, guys. That's called deflection. I give you 1,000 points.
They all attended a press conference yesterday, which was organized by the South African Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement.
Yeah, so finally, Angus hasn't organized one of these things.
But Gareth,
clearly too busy.
They say that the issue is not one of religion, but one of human rights.
Well, then why are you wearing your tall hats and coming there in your robes?
So in 1947, when Israel and Palestine were partitioned, Jerusalem was to be administered as an international city. But then a year later, Israel invaded a part of the city. And then in the war of 1967, Israel occupied the remainder of the city.
That's called winning it by war. It's happened all over the world for thousands of years. It happens. You've got to get over it. You can't keep complaining that you, but it's ours, but you lost it.
And then last week,
you should have fought harder.
And then last week, Wednesday, Donald Trump announced...
Some of the things you say.
Donald Trump announced that he had determined that it was time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
I love it.
And then a whole lot of people got upset, including people here at home.
Yes. Good for Donald Trump. I'm thrilled that he made Jerusalem the capital of Israel from an American point of view. Put your embassy there, and you don't have to listen to them, Donald. Bunch of whining, whinging losers.
I never thought I'd actually say these words, but can we cut President Trump some slack? And
no.
Like, we don't have to be shouting and screaming at him all the time. Yes, absolutely. I'm not saying have coffee with the guy, but I'm saying why are we opposing every single thing he does?
Because that's what people do. They've chosen their place.
Have to do, yeah,
in life, people...
That's what Mark Zuckerberg wants you to do.
People choose their lanes. People choose their lanes in life, and then it is their mission for the remainder of their lives to attack and...
Just knowing that he's breathing, people
everybody
will complain
has,
about
everybody
that.
In life has a lane, you know. Either you hate feminists, or you hate white people, or you hate this, or you hate that. Like, everybody
people
has a lane.
Hate white people?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
How did I miss that?
Yeah. I got my genetic ancestry attested and mapped out, and it was cool. But I was so disappointed because I'm just white, yo. I was hoping that I had
some
cool shit in there. No, I wanted some like Ethiopian things and like a bit of Asia.
You wanted
somewhere.
Something exotic.
I just wanted to not be the most hated creature in the universe, a straight white male South African that is as white as Casper, having not experienced summer in decades.
Oh, shame, God. Sucks to you, buddy.
Just so white, man. Bummer.
Okay, time for a little treasure hunt.
Uh-huh.
There are two former CIA agents who are hoping to find Pablo Escobar's hidden treasure.
Oh, nice. Now, that's a treasure hunt I'd want to be a part of.
Oh,
did you see all that money in Narcos?
Man.
Yeah, dude. And then they dug it up and some of it was all damp and manky.
Yes.
But
yes.
Someone must have wrapped some... But are dollars still the same as they were back then? Have they changed? You can use it.
Look, it's a whole story. So Escobar was at one point one of the world's biggest drug dealers. He was known as the King of Cocaine. And he was making so much money that at times his team was spending £2,000 on rubber bands to hold the cash together.
£2,000 how often?
Once a month.
Jeez.
Now, his Colombian house was incredible because it had a sculpture park in the grounds. It had a full zoo, which was complete with elephants and hippos. Yes, yeah, right up your alley. He had apparently like huge statues of dinosaurs knocking back.
Dinosaurs.
Knocking about, but I know, you know. When,
wow.
When, I guess when you
have
that much money.
Of dinosaurs.
I guess when you have that much money, you start, you know, thinking of weird things that you can buy.
Can you imagine being so rich that you think, I need a dinosaur
what
statue?
What would you have statues of if you were unable to squander? Like, you couldn't squander any enough. It comes in faster than your creativity can squander it. And you decide to have a statue park. What would you make statues of?
I would make statues of...
Hot dudes with their shirts off. And you, Gareth?
No.
More than just their shirts off.
God, please respect me. What are shirts off going to do? I would have statues of men with various penis sizes. From the teeniest,
from large
tiniest,
to very large to extremely large.
Biggest, lowest hanging, swinging.
Oh, wow. Mavs.
And then just look at them every day.
The one that can hold an apple.
Mavs would walk up and down an alley of these statues.
I must walk down
penis
alleyway.
And I would name
alleyway.
Them. I'd give them nicknames.
I must walk down penis
alleyway.
I don't know that
I'd be spending a huge amount of cash on statues. But
it's unsquanderable. We're at that level.
Yeah, but...
I would have various parts of my face. Just like a blown up version of my nose, a blown up version of my right ear, a blown up version of just like the corner of my chin, below my lip, like everything. Just walk around and see myself in different angles.
I would make all of my staff get their entire back tattooed with a portrait of me. That's the law.
You would brand them.
Yeah, they'd have to have
just saying how white you are. You've just proven it.
Yeah.
My slaves will all have my face on.
I'll pay them well.
Yeah, sure.
Because
they love having a picture
of you. No, shame. You would pay them well because you do believe in a little bit of socialism.
Yeah, a little bit of socialism. You would,
God.
Good schools,
socialism doesn't pay anyone.
Well, you would make sure that those less fortunate than him
that he employs.
Okay.
Okay. So at the peak of his career, Escobar was thought to be worth about $30 billion. Jesus. And the question that is now being asked
is... And that's
is,
in the day, hey?
That's like, back in the day. In the day. Yeah. Now, the question being asked is, what happened to the best part of his cash? He was eventually killed in a shootout back in 1993, but before that, he began hiding his money away from the banks, because, you know, banks are evil to a degree.
Sure.
He moved it offshore, with some being stashed in lots of Swiss bank accounts, although much of that will apparently never be seen again, as he only knew the codes to retrieving it. Then, Mr. Escobar, of course, was also a big fan of burying a lot of his money under the ground. Now, unfortunately for everyone, Pablo didn't exactly write down where all that money was kept.
Sure.
And also, he had a habit of killing the henchmen that he had employed to digging up... to digging up where the money would be buried after the fact, because he wanted nobody to ever know where the hiding
spot was.
And
you guys think it's rough to get my tattoo on your back.
Yeah.
Listen, listen, imagine you're digging around. You're some Colombian... You grow bananas. You've got like a tiny little banana farm, and you and your family eat bananas all the time because that's all you got. And you dig around in your garden one day, and it goes clunk. And you go, huh? And you dig a little more, and you dig a little more, and eventually there's this huge, big container.
Oh. Yeah.
And you think, oh.
The size of a minivan.
Yeah. And you go, let me see what's in there. And you crack it open with a crowbar, and there's just gold and
shrink
cash.
Shrink-wrapped money.
Yeah. Shrink-wrapped money and gold. And you go, I think I'm going to stop with the banana farm.
Yep. Yeah, just a little bit. It is estimated...
I'd immediately phone my local law enforcement and tell them I'd found something unusual.
Oh, come on.
Ask if they could send a constable to please come and find, okay, find out whose lost property this is.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, you bury that thing right away.
I would have tattoo artists setting up shop on my property within 24
hours.
By the
end of the day.
Yeah.
It is also estimated that at one point, at least a fifth of all U.S. dollar bills in existence were buried in Colombia. And the estimation...
One-fifth.
20%. At least one-fifth.
Yeah, I want to know what the thing is.
Was buried in Colombia, and it is estimated that that was all because of Escobar.
You know, like, it's bad to print money. This is what our government doesn't understand. So
is it bad or illegal?
Well, both.
No.
So if a fifth of your money is getting pissed away to Colombia, that's not good for your country. Like, I asked Anthony about this, because wherever you go, it's a third world country, you can generally pay in dollars. So America's printing all this money, but it's going to other countries. So what does that mean for them?
Yeah.
Like, value-wise, it can't be good.
Yeah.
It isn't. It's bad for the local economy.
Yeah, that's probably why they were so, you know, determined
to print.
To have him controlled.
But, like, make dollars American again. Like,
there you go, Ben. Trump would love you.
But I'm sure that there is catastrophic ramifications around this. No, especially if all this money is underneath the ground being eaten by weevils or earthworms or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to know.
Weevils are the cereal guys. I don't think they're the underground paper guys.
In Colombia,
yeah, I'd love to know what the state of deterioration of banknotes.
Guys, we have to check this money. It's got weevils.
So now the Discovery Channel.
The Colombian weevil is more vicious than the normal one.
Yeah, it is. It's very angry.
Have you seen what a weevil looks like?
Oh, no.
It's like a
beaver.
It's
like a living piece of dust.
It's like a beaver.
It's like a beaver.
But did you see that meme I sent?
Oh, okay. There's a weevil. It's an insect.
Did you see that meme that I sent you, Gareth, where the beavers were no longer willing to be used by a pejorative term, be referred to as a pejorative term. They now prefer their proper name, vagina squirrels. We will no longer be referred to as beavers.
I actually cannot.
So, just to wrap this one up, the Discovery Channel are now employing the services of the CIA because they want to be the ones to find Escobar's treasure.
Babs, what would you do if you dug up that treasure in your back garden?
Aside from cock statues.
Yeah, no, would you tell anyone or would you just...
No.
No.
Yay, though I walk through the valley of cocks.
I am not telling anyone. I'm going home. I'm going to take a week off to just think about things.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I'll start making decisions.
But you don't let anyone know,
no,
right?
You can't let anybody know.
No, you can't. Because then all kinds of people are going to be on your ass.
And you also got to figure out, you need an expert to help you figure out where to put that money. Like, seriously though, you got to figure out, like, you can't just
property
protect it physically. You know, like if you hire armed guard oaks to come protect your...
No, you hide it in the roof.
No, you don't. You, you don't, guys. You go buy property in Romania. That is the way to do it.
Really?
Why Romania?
Eastern and what, Europe. You're arriving with cash. Like, you, how do you move your bucky load of cash?
Well, you ask the Guptas the first step because they're very good at that.
Yeah, they've moved a lot of cash overseas. Right.
It's not even a joke, though.
Like, I reckon, how, I reckon they've got anti-weevil spray.
You run out of shit you can buy with fistfuls of cash.
Yeah.
You've got to find a way to launder that money. Firstly, to get the weevils off because it's not clean, and secondly, so that you can reintroduce it into the banking system.
Special weevil spray.
Guys, we need to figure out how to get more weevils.
If anyone is like an expert actually at this and that's listening, like how do you... No, that is listening, that is an expert at this. How do you take $100 million in cash that you found that's a bucky size bale of money, and now you've got to like figure out how to live with it.
What sort of expert are you hoping you'll find?
You never know
who a listener who are. Just happens to
all
also
we know about our listeners is that they're of discerning taste and that they're lovely people
and also international
and we don't know
criminals.
How many of them are money laundering experts.
Speaking of which, Lisa has some advice. Ben, Ethereum is the blockchain, Ether is what you trade, so it's one Ether.
Well, there we go.
Thank you, Lisa. Our listeners are much smarter than we are.
Amen, exactly.
Just on that, my 500 rand on the Ether is now 705 rand. Since we were talking.
I'm going to go and drop some money on this literally when I get
back.
Yeah,
you should.
Work.
When
you
Gord
should.
Starts getting involved, you know it's time to pull out. And then Graham has a couple of words for Gord. Gord, you give the government too much credit. It's plain and simple ineptitude and the lowering of education standards to increase pass rates. That's socialism in a nutshell. Giant lies perpetuated by the least capable. Basic, divide and conquer. People don't have ideas, says Graham. Ideas have people. They don't choose lanes. They have lanes chosen for them. Hating Trump is trendy. Most people couldn't give me three factual reasons why they hate Donald Trump. Usually the information in media is grossly extorted for asinine postmodern motives. Ironically, they don't even know that they are postmodernists. Talk about hating being white. What about hating being white because of the shitty subpar philosophy of mincing French white philosophers like Jacques Derrida?
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, well, that's clever. Clearly, but that was pretty much my question. Is it a deliberate strategy to uneducate a whole generation of people so they can't know your fuckery when they see it?
Yeah.
Or is it just things are poked?
Things are poked. Double D says, I love Mabale. She's not scared to take on Gareth. Gareth is offended almost every day and goes on rants.
But no, I'm just going to go on a rant.
That might be his job, but we just let you know.
And then... Double D also says, I agree with Rusty. We should not put all your eggs in one basket, though, especially when it comes to politics. Hearing different opinions from different sources is important. Absolutely. All right. When we come back, we're going to meet Michael and Kinga from Kolkakio. We've known them for a long time on the show, and it's time for you to get to know them, too. They are turning 20. Not them. Kolkakio is turning 25 years old this year. They both look like they're in their 20s. Huh?
They can't hear you, I don't think, out there. Monitor
not on?
There's a monitor speaker over there, Gord.
Well, I couldn't hear you guys talking when I arrived, and also couldn't hear you talking when I went for coffee during the squirrel singer.
Amanda took care of it.
Squirrel singer. All right, when we come back, we'll meet Michael and Kinga from Kolkakio's. That's next. How cool is that? That's Pascal and Pierce, huh? Haven't heard from them in a little while. A fantastic song. I do love it. Oh, got a bit excited there. All right, so it's time for us to get to meeting Michael and Kinga. We'll do that in a second. By the way, that song is called Running Wild with Jethro Tate, just in case you needed to know. Just after 7:30, apparently we've got someone on the line who can help us with how you launder cash.
Bucky full of cash.
A bucky full of cash. Yeah, good morning. We'll keep you anonymous, just in case, you know?
Yeah, no, rather.
All right.
So, the easiest way to launder money would be to go gambling. If you go gamble with that money, look, the biggest issue with it is being greedy and trying to keep all of it, cut your losses, go gamble, win a couple of thousand, 50,000 or 100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And you can go put it straight into your bank account. It's not taxable because it's winning. And that would be the easiest way of washing money without any eyebrows being lifted.
So go to the roulette table, bet on your favorite color, and just keep doing it until...
Until you win.
Well, he had to go.
He had to go. Yeah, they triangulate they your call him, yeah. after 40 seconds. But that's pretty useful. It's like, okay, so you're going to take the knock. Roulette's the one where you've got the highest chance, sort of mathematically.
The point
you're going to win 40% of your spins.
They don't know. Yeah, so as far as they're concerned, you know, they're not going to come and check, oh, so you bet on 35 that time and then you... Bet on 12 yeah. that time, and you won and won and won.
You just bet it on the one color, because then it's going to land, you know, it's got like a 40-something percent chance of landing on that color. And what you don't win is losses, and what you do win is winnings.
That's actually very good advice, because the moment you have to start involving other people in your criminal activity is when you open yourself up to being caught.
Yeah.
So well, if you gamble, there's nobody else involved.
It's great advice if you have a bucky load of cash. That
well,
you
I mean,
the size of a chest
yeah,
freezer.
Yeah, if you but find you Pablo's money, then you'll have the bucky of cash.
Do you not think, though, that like that SARS or someone's going to pick up that you win $180,000 worth of money at it's a
yeah,
day
but you don't do it all. No,
casinos.
You don't do it all. No, you've got to spread this out over like 3 years, and you've got to do it. Oh my God! I just won $1 million at this casino.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and you do it at the tables.
And they'll take your dollars at the casino.
Sure.
If you roll in with
you have to change them.
How?
No, if you dig up dollars, you're in a lot more trouble. You'd have to go and do that in another country, probably, to make it less obvious, because you only have a certain amount of foreign currency you're allowed.
But you found it. You got to move it.
No, you've got to if it's rand, you can go and spend it at casinos.
I see. I still want to actually understand how to do it. I mean, I appreciate that the caller gave us that insight because it is useful.
Definitely
but I still
a dodgy
feel like
person,
you haven't, sol-
well,
you haven't I mean, solved my entire problem.
That's a very dodgy person, whoever that was. All right. Let's meet our guests this morning. I've known Michael and Kinga for a little while. I wouldn't claim to be friends of theirs, but they are terrific people who started Kolkakios 25 years ago. The first Kolkakio was in the foreshore in Cape Town. Gord, you've been to that one, right?
I've been to many Kolkakios, yeah.
These two worked like slaves to start that business 25 years ago. Slaves in the kitchen. And yesterday I was made a slave in the kitchen.
Slave to the kitchen.
Oh, no. All right, so yesterday I was a slave in the kitchen for exactly, 15 minutes. And I learned how to make my favorite salad, which was lots of fun. But they're here now, and I thought we'd introduce them to everybody. So... Michael Taraspolsky, how are you, sir? It's nice to see you, man.
Good morning, all of you.
Good. Come forward to this microphone. I know radio is not your thing. Pizzas and salads and Kolkakios is. What do you want? Do you not like the microphone?
No, I like the mic.
You keep moving it away from yourself. Kinga, nice to see you.
Morning.
Good. Thank you for taking us through yesterday and showing us how the actual, like, the real work happens. Because everybody thinks, when you go into a restaurant, Mobs, you just see calm. And you see beautiful food, and you see happy people talking, and you see drinks being served, and all of that stuff. Meanwhile, in the kitchen, it's like chaos. It's organized chaos, but there are 20 people running around, doing this, chopping that, throwing this away, gathering this, making new stuff here. It's mad. I've never ever seen the inside of a restaurant kitchen in my life. It's something else. You guys used to work in there yourselves, too.
I still do.
Yeah, you still do.
Yeah, I still do.
Kinga designs all the items on the menu, by the way.
Oh.
Hope you like them.
Yes, we do.
And we talk about them all the time. But you two, how did you meet? Because I want to get into your story in a minute, Kinga, and yours, Michael. But how did you two meet?
So we both were from Joburg before we moved to Cape Town, and I used to frequent a restaurant in Ilovo, Cornuti.
Yeah.
Most of you might know it.
Absolutely.
And Kinga used to work there. And I used to go and eat there a lot, and that's where I met her.
Uh-huh.
I was a waitress.
She was a waitress, then there a manager. And then she opened Svigati down the road in River Club.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I was just a patron.
And then how did you end up coming up with this idea of starting Kolkakios together?
So I woke up one day, my parents probably would have said riffraff.
Yeah.
Pretty wild, going nowhere fast. And I literally woke up one day and I decided I want to be in the restaurant business. I'm going to be good at this. Never worked a day in my life in a restaurant. And I Yeah, I just knew it was going to be great.
How old were you at the time?
I was a late bloomer. I was about 27, 28.
Okay.
And my whole family had immigrated, so there was like nobody keeping an eagle eye over me. And I was wild. Hmm.
What is this, like partying every night?
No, I was
hanging around with rough people.
Yeah. I'm sure my friends would get a chuckle out of that. No, so I thought if I'm going to do this, I've got to do it with somebody who knows something about restaurants. I'm quite entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And I thought, I know exactly the person. So, and that was Kinga. So I approached her, and she was 19 at the time. And I said, let's go to Cape Town and open a restaurant, and we're going to be bloody good at this. And she said, well, how do you know? I said, I just know I'm going to be bloody good at it. You are already bloody good at it. So she agreed, much to my surprise. And we came down to Cape Town. I arrived a month or two before her to build the restaurant. And she came down and we opened the first Kolkakia on her 21st birthday.
Jeez.
She was in the kitchen. I was in the front. I learned how to cook pizza the day before. Not very well because on the first night I burnt all the food. And I had to give all our customers free food. True story. But I learned really quickly not to burn the food. And a lot of those customers, in fact, most of them are still regulars today, 25 years later.
I remember having my first pizza at Kolkakia in the foreshore, what was it, 20 years ago? My aunt took me there. And I thought, yes, this is a pizza. There's just something different about it. But it was memorable, and I've been a patron ever since. And it was nice to meet you guys and find out the story of the restaurant, how that happened. But how did your story together happen? Because you ended up married and you have two children.
Yeah.
You have two lovely girls. So how did that happen? Was that after you'd started the restaurant, or during, or before?
It's a little bit of a gray area, but it was you could say after. When we moved down, we were sharing an apartment.
Uh-huh.
And I guess just working 18-hour days and was spending 24 hours.
It's like Survivor. When you're on the island with people, you just, you know, you end up going, huh, okay. So he's not so bad. She's not so bad.
You either murder them or you hook up. One or the other eventually.
I think she's tried to murder me a couple of times. No, I'm just kidding.
But Kinga, you're originally from Poland.
Correct.
And you have, I mean, I thought this was a really interesting story because I don't know how many people in this country fully appreciate what kind of a life immigrants can have. You know, we often hear about people who have to cross the border from Zim or from Mozambique and how tough that is. But coming from Poland was no breeze for your family. Getting out of Poland wasn't even easy, right?
Sure. Well, my father had to run away.
Yeah.
My father was working in Iraq at the time, if I remember correctly. He was on contract. So you had to get a special consular passport to leave Poland. So he had this passport, and then my parents decided behind the scenes that they wanted to leave.
So Poland wasn't very pleasant.
No, I mean, it was the communist era, and they decided we were going to go on holiday. So we went on holiday to Austria, and subsequently we didn't go back.
Is that the best way to get out of Poland?
I think at the time it was. I think you either went to Germany or you went to Austria. You went to one of the countries that you could get out of. And also because there were the embassies and people would approach where to go, whether South Africa or to Australia. It was depending who was taking people in. At the time, with my dad's profession of being a mechanical engineer, Australia was prepared to take us.
So then you all had to go from Austria to Australia?
Correct. And then we lived in Australia.
So it was you, your mum, your dad, your gran?
No, not my gran, my sister. It was just the four of us.
All right.
It was just the four of us.
You ended up in Australia. And you couldn't speak a word of English?
No English. Yeah.
So you had to learn English from Australians. Do you know how hard that is? Do you have any idea how difficult it is to learn English from Australians?
They're liberal with their swear words.
So how long were you there for?
Just short of 2 years.
And how old were you at the time?
So we didn't, 11.
Wow.
So just for 2 years there. So we got here when I was just under 13. We had to, because the government pays for you to go to Australia, mm-hmm. Then because we were there just short of 2 years, we didn't get our citizenship, we didn't get our papers, and my parents had to pay back what it cost the Australian government to take us to Australia.
So then they were in debt.
Why weren't you keen on Australia? What didn't work out about going to Australia?
You know, because in Poland, I think South Africa was made out to be such a great country. They said, you come here, you play tennis, you almost see those lions walking in the streets.
Yeah.
But they made it out to be really good, and it was recommended that we come here.
So I think that's where my parents, when they decided, when they got the communication from the South African government and asking whether we still want to come, I think my father thought, well, we've traveled so far, maybe let's try. If there's, you know, he thought it was going to be better opportunities,
yeah.
Which I think it turned out okay.
Well, it turned out okay because you guys had to work your backsides off. I mean, you got here and it wasn't like it was a whole lot better.
No, not at the time. It obviously improved a lot later in life.
Is it true that you all had to live in a one-room place in Hillbrow?
We did, yes. And then we lived in another two-bedroom place with no fridge. Yeah, we did. We struggled. We really did.
And that's when you kind of started doing jobs in restaurants?
I started waitressing, I think I was 16, if I'm not mistaken, at the pizzeria in Yeovil. I can't remember the name of it. I think I was 16, and my sister started working. I can't remember what my sister's first job was, but we had to fend for ourselves. We had nobody doing anything for us. We had to do the ironing, we had to do the cooking, we had to do the cleaning at home. We did everything. We had to be self-sufficient. Very different to the lifestyle my children lead these days.
Yeah, but everybody's children these days compared to then. I mean, this is the long, hard yards that have to be put in.
Yeah.
Because people look at your business now that you two have got with, what, over 35 branches all over the country and even one in Namibia and all over the place. And they say, oh, well, this looks like a great business. It must be really, you're so lucky.
You know what, Gareth, I can tell you one
thing. They don't think about this part of the story.
No, but I think it was always a standing joke that I'm the Polish workhorse because it's been instilled in me. I think, and even the other day I was driving the car with my dad and my dad reminded me, he says, you forget how your grandmother used to give you the keys to the ice cream shop and say, go and open the ice cream shop, when it was at the time that I decided to go back to Poland because I missed my grandmother so much. And
how old were you then? 13?
Yeah, just after we came back. And I can't remember who it was.
You were opening up the ice cream shop at 13. I mean, that's just unbelievable.
You know, so I always had the work ethic. I think it's the work ethic was always instilled in me. The harder you work, the more you'll have. The harder you work, the more you'll have. And that was always the case. And I'm grateful that I've got that work ethic. It's amazing. I think Michael sometimes struggles with me. He says, you know, that my business always comes first. But it's not that. I've got that. I love my business and I've got the passion for the business and I'm glad that I've got something that I still get up for and I absolutely love it. I really do. And I know sometimes my franchisees maybe get a little bit put out by me because I go in there and I kind of say, listen, this is not right. But
your attention to detail is incredible. So I was in the kitchen yesterday, Mubs, and I was chopping up carrots and I said, is that okay? And she said, no, you must chop them a bit smaller. I was like, you know, that is, there's such attention to detail. That's why the stuff is good. That's why you know what you're doing. And you do love it. I could see you were in there. You were running around. You were, where are these seeds? I need the pickled onions. I need this. And you were just putting it all together.
I do love it, I must say.
And most people who would be doing that for 25 years would get bored and would hate it.
I have the days when I think to myself, yeah, I don't know how much longer, but as I say, my kids are also getting older now, and I guess we're getting into the next phase of our lives, and maybe I'll get into it even more than I am at the moment.
Do you ever cook for Michael at home and the kids?
I do.
She's an amazing, amazing chef. Well, we're spoiled at home.
Clearly, everybody else gets to share
a bad day at home. A bad day at home is a good day, I tell you.
It's not like that old chestnut of everybody has shoes except for the cobbler's son.
No.
No, but I don't like the everyday.
Do you have a really fancy kitchen at home?
No.
We got the worst kitchen.
Really?
Yeah, because we didn't have a lot of cash when we built that house. So we've got what we could afford at the time, and it's never really been upgraded. So
one crap oven. I mean, it's like open it up, close it with the leg, and get it all out.
And everybody lives around that kitchen. Our guests come, everybody's around the kitchen that counts. It all happens around that space. But King is amazing. I mean, she just whips up stuff. It's quite incredible. She comes in very quickly, and you've got a meal that's like way better than average. Way, way better.
Now, you said that all of your family had emigrated.
Yeah.
So were you on your own?
I was here alone. We were going to leave for the States in 1978, and my dad got cataracts in his eyes, and he had to give up that job. And he's a doctor. In 1982, my older sister left. In 84, my middle sister left.
Yeah.
And then my parents, my dad kept getting job offers in the States and turning them down, and eventually got a job offer at Harvard. And wow. He said, listen, if I don't go now, I probably won't get another one. He was 57.
Yes.
And he left, and my mom followed 6 months later with my little sister. She just finished matric. And I think they thought I'd just follow. And I like was freedom. So I never followed. And eventually I gave back my green card, which everybody says, you did what? I said, no, I gave it back. I could never live there. They're way too conservative and narrow-minded in the States. Not a place to live. Good place to visit.
And when you, here, and when you started here. This business, this was at a time in South Africa, 1992. Nobody really knew what was going on. This was not an easy time to start anything. It's funny, I was talking to Adrian Gore the other day about this. He started Discovery, right? Same time. He's 25 years old.
Look how, where he
look
is.
How well he's done. Yeah.
A little bit but, better than us.
Well, he's done okay. He's the kid's done all right.
We just drove past his building. Yeah, it's pretty okay.
It's huge. Have you seen the new Discovery building, by the way?
I'm yet to discover. I've yet to make that discovery.
It is Santon CBD.
It's phenomenal. Awesome. Anyway, he was saying, what a time to start a business. Nobody knew what was going on. 1992 was before our first general election, the proper, you know, the birth of our democracy. It was after the ANC had been unbanned. There was all that instability, Chris Hani, all of that stuff had happened in that time. No one with their head screwed on right would start a business then.
They thought we were crazy.
Right?
Well, people did think we were mad. We packed up our stuff. We went down to Cape Town and we opened a business. And I knew nothing. I mean, I went down there. I found a site in a building that was over 100 years old on a city block that did not have another building on it. And there were no other offices or buildings around us. And I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant site because it was this character building, 5 meter high ceilings. And even the agent who was showing me all these sites around town, and I said, what about the one in your building? And he said, you really want to put a restaurant there? I said, it's fantastic, absolutely. So he was just happy to sign the lease. And we went in there. I drew the plans for the restaurant myself with graph paper and a ruler, because we didn't have enough cash to get a designer to design our restaurant. So I drew it and I in triplicate, and I landed up at council, and the guy said, yes. I said, I'm here to give you my plans. I'm opening up a restaurant. He said, where they gave them to me. He said, what's that? I said, they're the plans. He says, you can't give me that. I said,
you
why not?
Architect.
He said, well, for a start, he says, they've got to be to scale. I said, they are to scale. He said, well, you know, you need to have colors for like the blue for the water and red for the electricity. I said, have you got some colored pencils? He said, yes. And I grabbed them and I put in the colors. And I said, here. He said, it's highly irregular, but I guess there's nothing quite, you know, wrong with them. And I said, well, there we go. He said, no, not so fast. He said, you've got to walk your plans through council. So I said, what does that mean? He said, you've got to go to each department. You've got to get a stamp from electrical, from hygiene, from everywhere. So I walked through council in 2 hours and I got every single stamp required for my plans. I think possibly the fastest plans passed ever in the history of plans.
And you
going
drew them with
council.
Your own hand.
And I walked downstairs and I got my business license, and then we had to go back and build the restaurant. We painted the floors of our restaurant ourselves. It was crazy.
And why Italian? Is because that's the background you came from. You were working in those classic old Italian restaurants.
Well, I guess it was the one restaurant that I worked at, yes, and I learned a bit. But we always knew that Italian is the way to go. You know, people don't get tired of pizza.
No.
Pizza and salad.
You do not ever get tired of pizza.
Of Italian food.
I've woken up some morning. I could eat it in the morning. I could eat it in the afternoon. I could eat it in the night.
It almost needs a Surgeon General's warning on it. Like, this is an addiction-forming substance. If you have a pizza problem, phone the following hotline.
But is it – you guys do all these things, and I mean, I'm not talking about – products, because it's something that I'm trying to plug here. I'm interested. You cater now to vegans. You give all these options to people who like, you know, gluten-free stuff, for example. I mean, is that a pain in the backside to keep extra stock for, or is it something that you want to do because you actually feel there's a creative need to service that part of the community?
So before Kinga jumps in, because I'm going to say that we've always been innovative. We've always wanted to be on the edge, leading rather than following.
Yeah.
And in that light, King is amazing. She looks around and she says, that's an area we've got to do something. And then she heads off and comes back with these amazing things. Sometimes I look at it and I say, you know, how many vegans are there out there?
Isn't it 10, right?
Maybe 11. 11.
And yet they constitute 80% of the traffic on Facebook.
at least 80% of the
traffic. Which is why we feed them so that they'll make a noise on Facebook. No, I'm just joking. But they are out there and they make a lot of noise. And the weird thing is, my kids at school, like, their friends are becoming like vegans overnight. Mm. I mean, they... Yeah. Like half the
It's very trendy.
Yeah. Vegans, yeah. I can't understand.
So how do you make nice stuff for vegans? Because most of it's awful.
My
poor sister, she's a vegetarian. She cooks these disgusting tofu strips.
She's at least allowed cheese and if she's a vegetarian.
No, but I tell you what, the vegan cheese that we have.
What do they make that out of?
They shouldn't be allowed to call it cheese.
Cashew nuts.
Yeah, it's made out of cashew nuts. And I think we've got a fantastic vegan cheese. I mean, you guys tasted it yesterday. Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
What does it taste like, Sia? Is it like cheese? You've eaten cheese, right?
Yes.
You never know with Sia.
Yeah, no. I had both the vegan margarita and also the vegetarian margarita, so that's made out of real cheese. I love both. And maybe it's because I made them both myself.
You did. He was employee of the month yesterday, wasn't he?
I called myself that. I don't know how much credibility it has.
No, but really, you can make the food really tasty. And I think that there's great products out there. And I think that we've been able to adapt and innovate really well. And I do think that that is what has kept us going for the 25 years.
I talk all the time on the show about I go there for salads, trying to maintain the fat bastardry problem. And aside from the salads being brilliant, I just always really like Kalkakia. So I can take friends there and they can have whatever they want and I can still have something that's quite healthy. And I do the make your own salad. The croutons, which is like the least healthy thing in the make your own salad, but I allow it. The croutons and the balsamic glaze are like the most power things ever. And then there's the
I saw how they made those croutons.
The roasted, they're so good. They're so much better than anyone else's croutons. And then my thing is roasted red pepper, butternut, shredded spinach, sesame seeds, the grilled chicken, the balsamic glaze, and if I'm feeling like living on the edge, then I go for the croutons as well. It's the best thing ever. Like, it's such a good salad.
He does. He goes on about it.
And the croutons. Time. I wanted to ask you, like, how did you manage to perfect the crouton?
I saw this huge, massive pizza bread, right?
Yeah. You said to me, what's that?
What is it? Yeah. I said to him, what is it? Because it was massive. It was...
What, like a giant baguette?
No, it's like a big flat pizza bread.
Oh, right. Yeah,
but
giant
a big
pizza
one, it's
base.
Like, it's huge. Yeah, it's like a base. And then...
And it's slightly thicker.
Yeah.
And it gets baked in a pizza oven. And then we cut it up and we turn it into croutons. So it's not that unhealthy. It's not your regular deep-fried croutons.
Blessed is the crouton.
So I think you don't have to feel that guilty.
I'm having a crouton today. I work right by Nicolway Centre and I'm like going to Kalkakia's this afternoon. They'll see me there.
We should have had you in the kitchen yesterday. Exactly. And Mabali, we missed her.
I would have loved it.
And Ben.
I would have eaten everything in that kitchen. I would have gone food rage, and you don't want to see that.
It was spectacular.
That'd be restocking urgency this morning.
On your app, Ben is a maestro. That doesn't really mean anything, though, does it?
No, it does.
You make a big deal. It just means I'm frequent.
He's one of the guys that helps us pay the rent, one of the regulars.
Yeah.
Well, is it this one really close to my house? That's the only excuse, really. But yes, but this is the worst week to have ever got ill. Like, I've been looking forward to this whole pizza-making thing for so long. And then, like, the 1 week I get ill, this is it. I had such FOMO looking at all those pictures yesterday on Instagram.
Well, guys, thank you so much for coming to spend some time with
us.
Thank you. It's lovely to actually introduce you to everybody else. And how are you doing in Joburg with the water? Isn't it nice?
Oh, boy, did I have such a great shower. Mm. Oh, my word.
It's good, huh? You just turn that tap
and
on.
And flush every time you want to.
I just went and flushed a few times.
I just flushed shits and giggles.
I hate to bring up something lavatorial at this point, but since you've already gone there. Gord had what he called the most awkward...
I can't go into this during the Kalkakia conversation.
No, I want you to.
Okay, so...
We've got to talk about this.
I'm trying to put this... Now I'm embarrassed, whereas earlier I was confident about the story. So I was working at the Sevens, having a very good time, but running around and being quite busy. And in the backstage area where the teams get all organized, there's also like change rooms for the entertainment. And so there's a there's a men's and a women's bathroom, and they it's big, and it's like a change room bathroom. It's got showers and toilets and this big area where people change. Yeah. So there's a men and a women's, but the costume lady that's dealing with my stuff and the lady I was working with.
Because you dressed up as a wolf.
Yes, I dressed up as a Viking with a wolf head.
Yes.
And my friend and colleague, Jade McKinnon, was also in the Viking outfit and doing drumming. So, and we good friends with the costume lady. So that was where we made our little camp in the ladies' change room bathroom.
Right.
And every now and again, like the cheerleading squad came in and I was like, cool, I'll step out for 10 minutes and go and grab, you know, something to drink. But for the most part, it was cool to chill there. Not a lot of nudity going on. But I, and it's okay to go for a wee there. They can hear you, but it's all right. That's not a biggie. But eventually there were worse problems on my hands. So I then decided, okay, cool. I'm going to go next door to the male change room, which is, in my experience, my two times I pop my head in there, it's empty. And there's nothing going on. And as I walk in, First Project, who are these? Are the buff drummers. They're like handsome. They do two things. They drum and they're good looking. They're buff drummers. All of them, I think there's like six of them, are doing push-ups and they're like flexing with their rubber band resistance bands, and they're getting like ripped for the show that they're about to do. And there's loads of them, but I had to go and do my business while the six handsomest men in the world were working out in the room next to me. It was either that or like the cheerleaders or the buffest, handsomest oaks in the world had to hear me.
Well, the cheerleaders, you don't want to make a noisy, you know.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. That's not an appropriate conversation for now. I was about to ask what everybody's personal favorite thing is at Kalkakia, but it feels like it's no longer.
I think you've ruined the moment.
Yeah, I tried not to. You ruined the moment.
I have spoken about this 1,000 times. It's San Siro salad. I learned to make it yesterday. I didn't like mine as much as I like it when someone else makes it. That's always the way it goes, right?
It's always like that, yeah.
Yeah, the salad a la gourde, as I've just described, is
salad a la gourde.
Yeah, I named it. Okay. That's my favorite. Cashews as well, but again, you're deviating further away from the diet compatibility if you crouton again cashewing. But if you're not concerned about those sort of things and you want to do an a la gourde, you chuck some cashews in as well. You guys?
Sure.
Yeah, what do you actually eat at your own restaurant?
I love pizza.
You
I
do?
I hardly ever have.
But you're so thin.
Thank you.
Well, how do you, because a lot of people think that you're going to get fat on pizza, but actually, is that true?
No, I've got good genes, I think. I don't think I'm ever going to be hugely fat, but I'm not in the best shape at the moment for me.
Okay. I can't even fit
into pizza, what kind?
I mix it up. I like the Inferno, the prawn peri peri. I like a bacon, blue cheese, ever and
what
chili.
Time do you guys open? No, seriously, what time what do Kalkakia's open? The Benmore one's nearby.
I'm healthy at the moment, so I'll have the zucchetti verdurosa, the spiralized zucchinis.
But you like the melanzane.
I like the melanzane parmigiana. I chop and change. There's so much to eat there these days. Get a steak.
So Ben is also Polish, but he eats more than cabbage. Isn't that impressive?
Well, it's a menu of many things, Gareth.
And that's potatoes.
This is where we are so different.
Some of the dishes probably have cabbage, I'd guess.
You know, are you guys doing a traditional Polish Christmas this year? You're going to all sit around the cabbage and have a leaf each?
No, it's every second year.
We don't have cabbage.
What is this, Zoom time?
So I have an issue with cabbage.
What do Polish people do for Christmas?
I have an issue with cabbage. Yeah. I can't stand it if it's cooked. I don't want it in my house. And Kinga brings home jars of this pickled cabbage.
See, he loves
it. See it in the fridge.
They can't help it. They're Polish.
What is it?
It's not pickled. It's cooked. It's awful. You know Bigos?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Michael.
It's a mixture of both.
No.
So what
no.
Do you,
it's delicious.
Do you Polish people have any fun at all?
Of course.
What do you do?
Not fun.
When they hang out with me.
Yeah.
I had a Polish mate. I don't know what's become of him, but high school and early varsity. No, I'm serious. I had a Polish mate, and he was too much fun. Ernest. Yassi.
Right, well, there's Gord's moment of kind of remembering his friend Ernest, who he doesn't care about anymore.
No, just the fact that he was too much fun as opposed to not fun.
Okay. Thank you, Gord. Denouement is what they call that in a story.
Okay. You would... stereotyping Polish people by saying they're not that much.
Do
they have any
fun? Explain the joke, Gord. It spoils everything. All right. Thank you very much, Michael, Kinga, Gord, Ben, Mavs, Sia, Amanda. Here's what you need to know. Billionaire businessman Johan Rupert has called a recent email allegedly from him to Helen Ziller as dreadful fake news. Turns out the BLF have tried to take over from Bell Pottinger in creating racial upheaval and perpetuating the white monopoly capital narrative for the ANC. Initial efforts have not been very good, but AJ Gupta has secured a pirated version of Photoshop so they can now get creative with some social media imagery going forward. It's going to be great. Oscar Pistorius got into a fight in prison this week, allegedly over the use of the prison phone. Further reports suggest it was actually over the TV remote. Oscar really wanted to watch the movie about himself on DSTV catch-up, but other inmates said it was cuck, and the woman playing Reva really wasn't that hot. They preferred to keep it on Boer Sugar Vrou. And finally, Steinhoff's involvement in SA Rugby has come into the spotlight since the company fell to pieces last week in a nefarious manner. To avert any further drama, the company's hired Alistair Coetzer to find some positives in the whole fiasco and are confident that he can turn the PR tide towards the right track.
And if he doesn't, it won't be on purpose.
Thank you very much. All right, we will catch up with Songeza Zibi next. I'm very excited to speak to him. Songeza Zibi is currently the head of communications at the Barclays Africa Group Limited. And he has also been the man behind many of the headlines in the Financial Mail and Business Day, which we'll talk to him about next. That's coming up just after 8 o'clock. CliffCentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.